This is an ABC podcast.
This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Coming up on the program this morning, regional leaders optimistic about the Australian government's pivot to the Pacific, but they're questioning why one key issue didn't seem to get a mention.
Because for us, the climate change issues are significant. They're at the front and centre of any development initiative in the Pacific Island countries.
And why are pro-independence groups in French Polynesia celebrating the New Caledonian referendum result to remain with France? We'll find out. Good morning. I'm Lauren Beldy. Those stories and more coming up on the program. But first, people born in Papua New Guinea when it was an Australian territory fear they could be left stateless under a complicated legal system left in place after PNG's independence. Descendants of Australian war hero Nancy Bird Walton have been caught up in recent weeks, which has sparked outrage from members of the PNG-born Australian community. But as Yara Murray Atfield reports, they're not the only ones facing the problem.
Joan Bird was born in Papua New Guinea in 1957 when it was still a territory of Australia. Her mother was a PNG citizen and her father, John Bird, was a merchant naval officer and an Australian citizen. But she's lived in Australia for almost all her life, leaving Papua New Guinea for good in February 1975, just months before the country became independent.
Worked and lived here pretty much since then, so all my life. Paid my taxes, voted, done everything that I needed to do.
Miss Bird, who also goes by the name Vatula, says she's done all of this on an Australian passport, with the assumption her citizenship was like any other Australian's. But now she's been told that's not the case. It's all due to the jumble of legislation surrounding Papua New Guinea's independence in 1975. Professor Kim Rubenstein is a citizenship lawyer and a law expert at the Australian National University.
When Papua New Guinea became independent in 1975, what the Australian law through a regulation act did was to strip all those Papuans who had been born in Australia and who had that citizenship, but strip them of that status.
Things were complicated further when PNG's new government ruled dual citizenship impossible.
They effectively said if you had that connection to mainland Australia, you could opt to take up Australian citizenship over Papuan citizenship.
So a cohort of people with ties to Australia and Australian passports left Papua New Guinea, unaware they were technically not citizens of either country. Professor Rubenstein has fought cases like this in court, including losing a 2005 landmark high court case that in the end found no matter their parents' heritage, people born in Papua were never real Australian citizens. Since then, the law has been changed to allow people with at least one Australian parent to apply for citizenship by descent, but many may not know they have that process to go through. It's such a complicated part of the law that it even has its own subsection in the Citizenship Act. Joan Bird says she's never had any issues in the past, but alarm bells rang when her sister Kathy had her citizenship revoked and her passport renewal declined 2 years ago. She says she was threatened with deportation and detention by immigration officials, which Border Force has denied. Their sister Marianne, an Australian Army reservist, has now applied for citizenship and has been granted a bridging visa. Joan, whose own passport expires early next year, asked Home Affairs to clarify her situation. She received a letter, cited by the ABC, warning of possible loss of citizenship.
Given what's been happening lately, it wasn't a surprise, but I think the aftermath of that now is just it's just dawning on me that now I have to go through this process or I have to fight it. You know, and it's daunting.
A spokesperson from the Australian Department of Home Affairs says in cases where a person was unaware they were not an Australian citizen, the department works with them to regularise their migration status. The Bird siblings are the nieces and nephews of Nancy Bird Walton, a famous Australian war pilot. So the case has attracted particular attention. But there are many more like Joan living in Australia. Pacific Beat has spoken to others who had one Australian parent and one parent from PNG, and after decades of living in Australia, found they might be rendered stateless. John Warmersley was born to two Australian citizen parents in Leh in 1948 and left PNG to live in Australia at the age of 17. He only realised his citizenship might be in jeopardy at 68 years old.
I was told that it was uncertain. There was a possibility that I might have ended up as a stateless person.
His application for citizenship by descent was approved around 2 years ago after providing detailed records of himself and his family. The struggles of the Bird siblings have sparked fears in others around the country.
I'm just worried that the threat of deportation is really real.
Corrine doesn't want to use her full name because she doesn't have her original birth records from PNG and she's worried she'll be removed from the country if she's identified.
It seems that I may be have rendered stateless due to political policy changes in both countries.
Like Corrine, Joan Bird says she's trying to find a way to fight for the citizenship she always thought she had, and says the law should change.
They need to fix it, you know, not us.
And she says she's encouraging people who are in a similar situation to come forward to shed light on the issue.
That's Yara Murray Outfield reporting there. Well, with yesterday's announcement from the Australian Prime Minister that the country is ramping up its commitment to the Pacific region came cautious optimism from regional leaders. They've welcomed the pivot to the Pacific, which includes a $2 billion bank for infrastructure projects. But questions have been raised as to why climate change didn't get a mention, considering it's often cited by Pacific leaders as the region's greatest development challenge. Here's Sally Brooks.
Cook Islands Deputy Prime Minister Mark Brown has welcomed Australia's pivot to the Pacific, but questioned if the shift is in the right direction. Australia's Prime Minister Scott Morrison promised money for infrastructure and diplomatic missions in the Pacific, but there was no mention of funds to battle climate change.
We'd like to see those issues around climate change more accurately clarified, because for us, the climate change issues are significant. They're at the front and centre of any development initiative in the Pacific Island countries. So we welcome engaging more with Australia to see what further commitment Australia will provide, not just in the infrastructure fund, but also in their contributions towards the effects of climate change.
The lack of climate change funding didn't come as a surprise to Mark Brown, particularly after Scott Morrison said last month Australia will stop payments to the United Nations Green Climate Fund. The Australian Council for International Development's Mark Purcell was quick to question if the funding saved by cutting payments to the UN Climate Fund will now be used for these specific initiatives.
The irony is the announcement does incorporate elements of the Australian Aid Program, and there have been cuts to bodies such as the United Nations Green Climate Fund. And what we've heard in the media is this specific step up will be funded by cuts elsewhere in the aid program, such as for that climate change body. So there's some deep ironies there that we're cutting climate change programs at a global level, but we do nothing in this space at a Pacific regional level where there's so much need.
Former diplomat and senior fellow at Australian National University, James Batley, says when it comes to climate change, Australia's position continues to drift further away from its Pacific neighbours.
There'll continue to be a gap between Australian and most Pacific Island perceptions on that issue. That's something that, in fact, that gap's been there for quite a long time. It's something that governments have really learned to manage. Arguably, the gap's growing larger. But I can't see that situation changing under this government.
James Batley says Pacific countries want long-term commitments.
There's been a bit of a pattern over many years of Australian government talking a big game, but not always delivering. I think, I'm not saying that governments will be sceptical, but they will be looking for long-term implementation and commitment.
The Australian government's new initiative comes as leaders from around the world, including Chinese President Xi Jinping, prepare to attend the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation in Port Moresby next week. PNG's Deputy Prime Minister Charles Abel is backing Scott Morrison's renewed commitment to the Pacific, but warned Australia not to take PNG's support lightly.
In our general view, that Australia also needs to step up. They need to maintain their presence and influence in the region as well. We're great partners with China, great partners with Australia and America, and we're happy to do business with all of them. But we kind of expect in many ways a little bit more from Australia because of the traditional relationship, and so we want them to maintain there and not take things or not take Papua New Guinea for granted.
That was Papua New Guinea's Deputy Prime Minister Charles Abel ending that report by Sally Brooks. And China's Foreign Minister Wang Yi has told his Australian counterpart, Maurice Payne, there's a need for more positive energy between their two countries and that they should work together in the Pacific, not against each other. Senator Anne Rustin is the Assistant Minister for International Development and the Pacific. She spoke to the ABC's Frank Kelly on RN Breakfast a short time ago and says yesterday's announcement was not just because of a rising China.
Look, the response yesterday was is something that we've been working on for some time. We've been looking
No doubt, but that doesn't mean it's not for that reason.
No. I was going to go on to say that we've estimated that the Pacific needs about $3 billion a year of investment infrastructure spent over the next 10 years, and we believe that Australia has a role to play in it. Up until now, we have been providing most of all of our investment infrastructure investment into the Pacific by a means of grants, and we thought by accessing loan facility as well as a grant facility that we will be able to make Australia's funding that we're making available to the Pacific to go further. So we're very much focused on responding to the discussions and consultation that we've had with the Pacific about what they would like to see happen. And yes, this is about regional security. It is about regional stability. It is about regional sovereignty. Nobody's making any, not denying that, but we are very focused on playing our role as one of the major players in our own home region.
That's Australia's Assistant Minister for the Pacific, Anne Rustin. Well, the opposition has been promising to focus on the region too. In September, the party said it would put the Pacific front and centre of its thinking. The Labor Party's defence spokesman, Richard Marles, spoke to the ABC's AM program a short time ago.
It's good that they have followed us in this direction. I make the point that when Bill Shorten announced this a few weeks ago, it was an important part, but only a part in a much wider strategy in respect of the Pacific, and one which would see Australia changing its relationship with the Pacific in a transformational way. You know, we need to see that from the government as well. And I think one of the other points here is that central to Australia's relationship to the Pacific has to be climate change. This is an issue felt in a very existential way in countries like Kiribati, Tuvalu, Marshall Islands, coral atoll nations, which are only 1 or 2 metres above sea level. And, of course, the government are hopeless when it comes to climate change. They don't have anything like a credible domestic policy, let alone a willingness to stand up and help support the Pacific in telling their story in respect of climate change. So this is a huge flaw in terms of where the government's at.
That's Labor Defence Spokesman Richard Marles on the ABC's AM program with Sabra Lane.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
And I'm Lauren Beldy. Thanks for your company this morning. Well, New Caledonia might have voted to remain as part of France at last weekend's referendum, but in another French Pacific collectivity, the result is being hailed as a crucial step towards self-determination there. French Polynesia's pro-independence party wants its own vote on self-rule and says the close result in New Caledonia has put France on notice. Here's Susie Rains.
Last weekend's vote might not have delivered full sovereignty to New Caledonia, but the pro-independence camp in another French territory is celebrating.
44% in favour of independence. I mean, it's full of hope.
Michel Villard is the International Affairs Advisor for French Polynesia's Independence Party. He says the referendum's tight result is a clear sign the metropole's days of colonial rule in the region are numbered.
Small percentage of the Kanak political party has decided to boycott the vote. Even with this difficulty, it's a success. So we can say now that for the next referendum, it gives maximum hope. Whatever will happen in New Caledonia, it will have a mirror effect in French Polynesia. And I believe that France has realized this with this particular 44% vote. This is a very important figure.
An important figure that defies most polls, which had predicted support of up to 70% for the pro-French campaign, a margin that would have cast doubt on the need for a further two referenda, promised under the 1998 peace deal. Those votes are scheduled to take place within 4 years and are considered more likely to favour independence because Kanaks who boycotted the first round are expected to participate next time.
For the population in French Polynesia, it's creating awareness and it shows that the term of independence is not synonym of disorder. It can happen in a correct way under the aegis of the United Nations. It has to be discussed on a bilateral way with the administering power, France. So it gives hope.
But such a bid for independence would have to proceed without the backing of French Polynesia's ruling party. The territory's president points to his general election victory in May as proof that a majority of voters support the status quo. Here's Edward Fritsch speaking through a translator at the United Nations Decolonisation Committee last month.
The acceptance by the French Polynesian population of the political line of the pro-independence party is declining. In May of this year, the French Polynesian people reaffirmed its choice and its right to remain an autonomous country within the French Republic, because the French state is an indispensable partner to us for the harmonious development of our country.
That's a position accepted on the streets of the French Polynesian capital, Papeete, despite evidence of a will to change eventually.
Me, I would really like Polynesia to become independent, but not for today, because we are not yet ready, given our actual budget is nearly 60% from France, and so we couldn't ask for independence.
Ready? Maybe not yet, but it's important to be careful because there are a lot of young people coming through who don't have work, who don't have a future.
Susie Rains with that report. Well, the Solomon Islands government has stepped in to allay fears about the rate of progress on preparations for the Pacific Games in 2023. The team leader of the Games National Task Force, Gabriel Suri, has been voicing his concerns in the Solomon's media about delays in putting the Pacific Games Act into practice. As Richard Hewitt reports, the Secretary to the Prime Minister, Dr. Jimmy Rogers, doesn't deny there have been hold-ups, but he insists there is no risk of the Games collapsing as they did in Tonga last year.
After the debacle in Tonga, the Pacific Games Council is keen to avoid being bitten again, so the rules governing the conduct of the host nation have been tightened, and the Council's Chief Executive, Andrew Minogue, says deadlines for Solomon Islands are close.
We signed an agreement with the Prime Minister back in April that put some more deadlines into our overall host contract, and it really did call for these sorts of measures that we're talking about now, setting up the hosting authority, getting the Act implemented, etc., to be done by the end of this year. So I think we're all a little bit nervous if it doesn't happen.
The delay seems to have been caused by a chain of events that saw the Prime Minister's office take control of the Games mid-year. A budget for the National Task Force wasn't signed off until September, and as a result, their report and recommendations were only recently handed to government. But Secretary to the Prime Minister, Dr. Jimmy Rogers, says everything is on track now.
So there are a number of things that are responsible for the delay, I guess. And one of them is that the task force not have received the financial resources they require to complete the draft. I don't quite know, because since it came over to the office of the Prime Minister, we've been moving. We got a plan of work right up to 2023. That's on schedule now.
The first meeting of the National Hosting Authority is now scheduled for the first week of December. And if that happens, then that would certainly send a reassuring message to the Pacific Games Council.
We are now in the process of establishing the National Hosting Authority, which is the primary requirement of the Act. And the National Hosting Authority will have 8 members. 4 of them will be appointed by the government, the minister responsible for the Pacific Games, which in this case is the Prime Minister. 3 of the members will be appointed by the National Olympic Committee of Solomon Islands, and 1 appointed by the Pacific Games Council.
Andrew Minogue says the council has deliberately made it tougher for Solomon Islands to carry out the task of hosting the region's biggest sporting event, so that any cracks in the plan show up a lot sooner than they did in Tonga.
The reason we did that is not to pick on the Solomon Islands, it's learning from the experience with Tonga. We need to know earlier if the country that's hosting the games, if they're finding it difficult, if things aren't settled and there's any risk attached to it. And Solomon Islands need to be ready next July when they come to Samoa for the Games, to be presenting themselves as a country that's capable and ready to host in 2023.
Critically, when hosting responsibilities are formally handed over to the Solomons at the end of the Samoa Games next year, the National Hosting Authority will have to demonstrate that the necessary finance is in place. But between now and then, an election is due and a change of government is possible. However, Andrew Minogue says the Pacific Games Council sees no cause for concern at this stage.
We're not detecting any of the sort of negative signals that we might have seen in Tonga by comparison a few years ago when their new government was elected. The indications that we've got are that they want these games and they're doing everything they can to make sure it happens.
Right now, both sides of Parliament are supportive of Solomon Islands hosting the Games, so hopefully there is bipartisan support.
And Dr. Jimmy Rogers says everyone involved in planning for the Games is determined to deliver a lasting legacy for Solomon Islands.
The way that we have looked at designing the Games, and this is also a credit to the task force that Gabriel Suri has led, is there has to be legacies built into the plan so that after the Games, the facilities that are built for the Games are also going to be useful for the country and not become white elephants.
It's Dr. Jimmy Rogers there, Secretary to the Solomon Islands Prime Minister, delivering a positive message on progress ahead of the country's hosting of the Pacific Games in 2023. And the reporter there was Richard Hewitt. With less than a week to go before Fiji's national election, the High Court in Suva yesterday heard prosecution claims that former Prime Minister and ex-coup leader Sitiveni Rabuka, who now heads the opposition SEDELPA party, should be convicted for failing to declare income and information about tax liabilities to the electoral office. If that was to happen, it's expected to see Mr. Rabuka disqualified from contesting the election, which will be held next Wednesday. Pacific Beat's Catherine Grau is following the story. Catherine, just 5 days to go and still uncertainty over whether Mr. Rabuka will even be allowed to stand in the election.
That's right, Lauren. It's been confirmed the judgment on this case involving Mr. Rabuka will only be handed down by Fiji's Chief Justice, Anthony Gates, on Monday afternoon. Now, of course, that's going to be less than 2 days before the official election on November 14th. But it's perhaps best to recap how Mr. Rabuka has found himself and his fate in the hands of the courts just days out from the 2018 poll first. So Fiji's Independent Commission Against Corruption had charged Mr. Rabuka under the country's political party regulations for failing to declare his assets with the election office. In this case, they were tax liabilities worth hundreds of thousands of dollars. Now, about 2 weeks ago, a magistrate had thrown those charges out on various grounds and therefore acquitted Mr. Rabuka. At the time, was considered that he would be able to stand in the election, but FICAC immediately appealed that decision by the magistrate. Doing so, it says, on 15 grounds of what it said were fundamental legal and factual errors, including that it believed that the magistrate was actually wrong when he'd stated that Mr. Rabuka's omission in declaring his assets and liabilities was an honest mistake. So Chief Justice Anthony Gates yesterday heard the oral submissions for that appeal from both the prosecution and the defence lawyers.
So were there any significant developments during the proceedings?
Well, local media is reporting lawyers for FICAC, that's the anti-corruption body, told the court that they believe they've provided sufficient evidence to prove the case beyond reasonable doubt. It's also reported that FICAC alleged in court that Mr. Rabuka had deliberately omitted the information. Now, in response to our request for more information from FICAC, given we're not there, I was advised by the anti-corruption body that it wouldn't be releasing any details or making any statements on this case because it is still before the court. Now, in response, though, to those claims made by FICAC, the lawyer acting for Mr. Rabuka, Philemoni Vosorongo, told the court that Mr. Rabuka had nothing to gain by admitting the information when he did declare his assets, his income and liabilities to the supervisor of elections. So his comments suggest that the lawyers are maintaining that it simply was a mistake. The court did hear that Mr. Rabuka didn't get any assistance from a tax agent when he went to the supervisor of elections with that information, but he had received a help when he cleared his liabilities with the Fiji Revenue and Customs Services.
So it's expected that Chief Justice Anthony Gates will now deliberate over the coming days.
That's right. As mentioned, the judgment will be handed down on Monday afternoon, 3 p.m. Fiji time. Now, Fijians go to the polls starting early Wednesday morning. If Mr. Rabuka is convicted, it's expected that would rule him out. If not, though, then he will remain on the ballot papers on Wednesday. But, Lauren, this week, thousands of Fijians have already been voting in pre-polling. So what would happen to any votes that have been cast this week for Mr. Rabuka remains to be seen still. In Fiji's electoral system where there's only one constituency, voters for individual candidates first really count towards their parties and they help determine how many seats in Parliament their party will end up winning. So any loss of votes that had been for Mr. Rambuka could really impact the total number that Sedelpa ends up winning. We understand the Electoral Office has been receiving legal advice on what it should do. Should that be the case come Monday if Mr. Rambuka is ruled ineligible? But having taken a look at the wording of Fiji's Electoral Act myself, it's pretty clear. It seems to say that votes cast for candidates who've been disqualified before the polling day will be deemed as invalid and, quote, shall not be counted.
That's Catherine Grau there. And that ends this edition of Pacific Beat. You can hear us again at 3 p.m. PNG time with Richard Hewitt. You can find our top stories on our website. Just type Pacific Beat and Radio Australia into your search engine. I'm Lauren Beldy. Thanks for your company this morning. Have a wonderful weekend. Bye for now.